Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. This is the first function we've had in this room, and thanks to the US Consulate for advising us that the Secretary, Deputy Secretary, was in Sydney. He just arrived this morning, and he's full of energy, which says something about the Deputy Secretary, but also something, I guess, about United Airlines, because he flew United, and look how fit he is. So there you go, and that's good to see. So I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Thomas R. Nides has worked in business and in finance. He's worked for Burson Marsteller. Before his current job, he worked for Morgan Stanley. But he's also worked in politics. He served in the Clinton administration, and he was also a chief of staff to the Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives, Tom Foley. Thomas R. Nides is now Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources and serving as the Chief Operating Officer of the State Department. And he was appointed by President Obama and confirmed by the Senate in December 2010 and sworn in January 2011. And today, Mr. Nides is going to address the Sydney Institute on the topic, the United States and Australia, partners in sustaining prosperity in the Asia-Pacific. As usual, the speaker will speak for about 30 minutes. We'll take some questions and discussion and end no later than 7 o'clock. Mr. Nides, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would be lying to tell you that I'm well-rested. That would be a lie. And although that said, it's certainly and a great honor and privilege to be here. United Airlines, although treated me well, the sleeping pills also helped as well, and maybe even a little scotch. But beyond that, I'm honored to be here. I'm here to attend the Pacific Island Forum. It is not a coincidence that it's also the World Cup during the same weekend. Shocking, as I and many other leaders around the world will be attending in New Zealand. So it's a great privilege that I'm here, and thank you for the introduction. As you know, about 60 years ago this week, our country signed the Australia-New Zealand-U.S. Treaty. It was a time of tension and uncertainty across Asia-Pacific, and World War II had just ended. The Cold War was beginning, and we cemented a partnership that has withstood the test of time. Today, Asia-Pacific is a very different place. Skylines are rising and poverty rates are falling. Hundreds of millions of lives have been transformed by peace and growth. Amid all the change, our friendship with the Australian people and your government has remained very strong. Our soldiers have fought side by side in every major war of the century. Together we have made the world a safer place. And we view Australia as a go-to ally and a partner in Asia and across the world. Today, America is focused on a changing Pacific. We're strengthening and broadening our alliances. We're reaching out to emerging powers like China, India, and Indonesia. We are more engaged than ever with institutions like the ASEAN and the East Asia Summit. And we have the frequent flyer miles to prove it. Being a resident Pacific nation isn't about our military or diplomatic presence. We are about engaging as an economic power and a partner as well. That's what I'd like to spend a few minutes and talk to you about today. Before moving to the State Department, I served as the Chief Operating Officer of Morgan Stanley. I approach these issues as a diplomat and a recovering businessman. In that spirit, I'd like to focus my remarks on how America and Australia can work together to achieve shared prosperity, fair economic competition, and sustainable growth across the Asia-Pacific region. I start with the idea that our economic futures are linked. Our economic revival depends on our ability to reach new markets, new customers, and new centers of growth. The Asia-Pacific now accounts for over one-third of our global economic output and $320 billion a year of American exports. Australia, for its part, has a deep economic ties on both sides of the Pacific. Your economy is even more focused on foreign trade than ours. You export to China, Japan, and Korea, while America remains Australia's largest partner for inbound and outbound investment. The Asian economies look to both of our countries as sources of innovation and trade and as champions for open markets. The key question now is, how can we create the conditions that will sustain shared economic progress across our region? As Secretary Clinton put it about six weeks ago in Hong Kong, how do we turn a generation of growth into a century of shared prosperity? We know we have plenty of work ahead to sustain America's leadership in the global economy. Rest assured, we are working on it. We're investing in our own infrastructure, in clean energy, health, and education. And as I can tell you, we're also reforming our financial system. And while progress in democracies can be a bit messy at times and halting, we continue to work to make the difficult choices necessary to rein in our own deficit. We also know that our country has the enduring strengths that aren't going anywhere. More patents than any other nation, the world's best universities, the most productive workers in the world, and a culture of entrepreneurship where a couple of the kids who live in a dorm room can create a company like Facebook. People and nations have bet against us before. Those of you who are old enough to know that the last time we had these discussions about the Americans' decline, a group of young Americans were quietly investing and inventing Microsoft, Apple, and the Internet. As Mark Twain would say, reports of our demise are greatly diminished. Together, America and East Asia have work to do to rebalance our global economy. As Chinese President Hu, President Obama, and the G20 have all agreed, America must borrow and spend less and save more. Many Asian economies need to act on their recognition that their continued growth requires stronger domestic demand. But we all have an even greater long-term challenge. We have to come up together to agree on the rules and the principles that will guide economic competition. It is no surprise that when we look to Australia as a kindred spirit in promoting the truly shared values. As Secretary Clinton has explained, we seek a global economic system that is open, free, transparent, and fair. So let me just take a minute to explain these principles and what they mean to us. Open means that people everywhere can participate in markets everywhere they want. We seek to open our economy to trade and investment from talented people everywhere. This includes Australians who have not only stolen the Tour de France from the Europeans, but you've taken over Hollywood and Oscars as well. Did you know that Google Maps was developed by the team's company Sydney team? And the highly complex trailing edge components, you may know them as wing flaps on Boeing's Dreamliner passenger jet, which will radically improve the fuel efficiency in civil aviation, are being manufactured down in Victoria. We count on this type of openness as a source of strength, and we value our collaborations with you. Second, we seek a free global economic system. Free means that ideas, information, products, and capital can move without unfair and unnecessary barriers. That includes everything from internet freedom to open doors for Americans and Australian investors in every country. Third, transparent means that regulations are known to all and applied to equally to all. It means widespread participation in writing the rules and the broad respect for the rule of law. Finally, these three contribute to the fourth principle, which is fairness. That is what sustains the faith of people, companies, and governments. And it's a challenge when supply chains are blocked, or when countries refuse to protect intellectual property, or force companies to give it away just to enter a new market. Without fairness, there is no trust. And without trust, people tend to protect their narrow interests at the expense of shared growth. These values do not belong to one country. They're the Australian values, every bit as much as they are American values. They don't belong to Westerners only. These are the values of businessmen and women across Asia, from Vietnamese manufacturers to Indian investors to Chinese artists. These principles are easy to say and difficult to implement. But those who enjoy the benefits of an open economic system must take responsibility for sustaining it. Let me tell you the steps that we're taking to promote these principles around the world. First, we're promoting trade and investment. Our countries have had a high-quality free trade agreement since 2005. And we've seen trade surge between our two countries. America and Australia are working to sign cutting-edge trade deals with other partners as well. We're aiming to sign deals that don't simply lower tariffs for certain goods, although that's certainly important. We want to do more. We want to seek open markets and provide protections for our investors for high-value service sectors, both areas where U.S. and Australia enjoy strong comparative advantages. We recognize the importance of fair go. For our citizens at home, we want to see fair competition abroad as well. Our FTAs include provisions to ensure that our trading partners respect the intellectual property rights and don't allow anti-competitive practice that hurts consumers and competitors. Similarly, both the U.S. and Australia know that strong labor rights and environmental protections have been the essential ingredients of shared and sustainable prosperity at home. And we want to see our trading partners playing by the same rules. Accordingly, we integrate these concerns into our FTAs to ensure that free trade does not just promote growth, but promotes the right kind of growth. That is the spirit that defines the Oz-FTA and the economic relationship with Australia. It inspires the bilateral free trade agreement with America is close to finalizing with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama. And we are hopeful that as Australia negotiates deals with larger economies throughout East Asia, it too will insist on promoting economic growth that is widely shared and sustainable. Even as we pursue bilateral deals, our long-term goal is to create high standards that will allow our true regional economic integration. The most promising vehicle to get us there is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or better known as the TPP. The idea is to bring together the economies from across the Pacific, from Brunei to Vietnam to Peru and Chile to the United States, to form a single trading community. The TPP can be an enormous game changer for the entire region. It can set the stage to bring about a genuine free trade area for Asia Pacific. But we need to do this right, and we're counting Australia's folks to help us. Second, we're working through the Asian economic institutions to promote the principles of fair economic competition. We're pleased to be chairing APEC this year. Australia was a founding member of APEC formed 20 years ago and remains a leader in a working towards the bolder goals for free trade and investment. APEC is as very bit as vital to Australia's economic future as it is to our own. We welcome our partnership and we appreciate your help on APEC's structural reform agenda and so many other shared challenges. Third, we're partnering with Australia to find a better and smarter ways to promote development. This lies at the heart of our efforts to create stable, cohesive societies, as well as new customers and markets for our products. When Secretary Clinton and Foreign Minister Rudd meet in San Francisco next week, they'll discuss some of the ways we're working together to reduce poverty. Without stealing any of my boss's thunder, I will mention that AusAid has the wealth of experience and expertise for other donors, including us, to draw upon, especially in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. Australia has a special opportunity to help those countries build the capacity, the institutions, and the regulatory framework to be part of the Asians' economic future. AusAid and USAID are also working together to confront the source of instability and extremism in the frontline states. In Afghanistan, Australia, aid dollars are funding education for young girls, and in Pakistan, AusAid is helping the country recover from the disastrous floods of July. And in Libya, Australia has been the third largest donor to provide humanitarian assistance. We are very grateful for those efforts. The final part of our strategy, and I want to mention this, we're creating new partnerships with other governments, with NGOs, and with the private sector. I've made it my focus of work to mobilize the American business community to invest in places where there are not only profits to be made, but important national interests at stake. We have brought together business owners to connect them with opportunities in Iraq and Afghanistan. Early this summer, in Baghdad, I celebrated the opening of the American Chamber of Commerce in Iraq. And we're working with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to encourage companies to invest in ways to help Japan in their recovery. All of our companies, American companies, Australian companies, Asian companies, have an important role to play in promoting inclusive, sustainable growth. Sometimes this is simply as asking the private sector to do so. Other times, we need to work together to set a new standard for responsible corporate behavior, for human rights, economic inclusion, labor rights, and environmental stewardship. And at all times, we have to urge companies to recognize that the long-term stakes of building prosperity, as well as the need to make a profit. It's a big agenda. We're working to create jobs at home by strengthening the global economic system. We are working bilaterally, multilaterally, and with a wide range of actors. We're working to sustain a system of rule-based competition that is the key to prosperity everywhere. And we're working to improve the character of that system to make growth more inclusive, more sustainable, and more beneficial to more people. All these challenges point towards Australia. At the turn of the last century, an American Secretary of State declared that the Pacific is the ocean of the future. The future is now. Our challenge is to seize it and shape it to bring prosperity to Americans, Australians, and people everywhere. And as we do, just as we always have, look to the Australia as a trading partner, as an ally, and as a great friend. Thank you very much.
Many thanks. Just stay there. Thanks to Clayton Utz for the use of this fine facility this evening. It's the first time we've been in this room, so thanks to Clayton Utz for that. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish, we'll finish well before 7, but we've got plenty of time. Can I just lead off? As you know, we share a lot in common with the United States on economic matters. I guess, to some extent, our relationship with China is a little bit different. We mainly export minerals to China, and you mainly import from China. So, although this is becoming an issue here as well, you have a bigger issue with the Chinese currency than we do. I mean, what's the current attitude of the administration to the disinclination of the Chinese government to float the Chinese currency?
Well, I don't since I don't work at the Treasury Department or at the Federal Reserve, I try not to get involved in monetary policies. That said, let me just put it in a larger context. You're right to suggest that the fact that the Australians have as much at stake in the relationship with China, and probably more so than even the United States. Although we were reminded during the debt crisis when we were trying to raise the debt ceiling that the Chinese owned $1 trillion of U.S. debt. As I like to point out, it's not as if they had a lot of options of where they're going to put those monies. The fact of the matter is the U.S. currency still is the standard of currencies for the world and certainly is a safe investment, as it's proven to be the case over many a year. As it relates to Australia, as you know, almost 30% of your export market is now going to China. And obviously, you're very much dependent upon a strong Chinese economy to sell those minerals and those things to the Chinese. As it relates to the fact of the economy and the currency, obviously, our position has been quite clear for a long period of time, which we want, obviously, for there to let the currencies fluctuate as the markets pertain. Obviously, it's what you do here in Australia, it's what we do in the United States. We try to give them as much encouragement as we can, including a lot of discussion around both multilateral and bilateral. They obviously understand our views of this. Listen, the Chinese have done a very good job of managing their economy during a fairly difficult time. They do have their own issues in which they're dealing with. But the importance of the relationship between us and the Chinese is certainly critical for our long-term growth, both for obviously Australia. But quite frankly, one of the reasons I'm here, and I think one of the reasons we have such a large delegation, the Pacific Island Forum, we have the largest delegation we've ever had, U.S. delegation, the Pacific Island Forum. Not only is it the celebration of the 40th year of the and not only because of the Rugby World Cup, but the reality is that the importance of the Asia Pacific as not only a trading bloc but a strategically important to us. We want to make sure we're here, we're on the ground, and that not only the relationship between Australia and New Zealand, but the islands are critically important for our long-term economic security. Working within the constraints, including working with our friends in China and India and many of the other Asian countries, we hope to focus and to make sure that our economic security is laid out very clearly in one of the roadmaps in which we're trying to do, which is laying down the foundation for a long-term relationship.
There's a question here.
Yes, recently it looks as if the Chinese government had a pretty good look at the United States Defense Department and a large area of the United States in that area, military preparations, everything. Now, how can you protect intellectual property rights? Can you get agreements that people will honor, or can you actually put up barriers that people can't get into things?
Well, I think it's this has been a struggle for a long period of time. We can't, you know, our hopes is that we have, as I pointed out in my speech, free and fair trade. That includes with our friends in China. Our hope is that our markets are open, that we have very solid trade relations, as you do with the Chinese. But we have to be diligent and focus on intellectual property rights, on areas where we believe fundamentally that we have very much focused on the needs of the property and, quite frankly, intellectual rights that we believe and occasion are not completely inclusive in what our current agreements are. So we're very much focused on that. I think the reality is that we have what the Chinese want, which is a very large market. Okay. And we want to keep the ability for Chinese products to flow into the United States as you do in Australia. We expect the same reciprocity in our goods going to China through either financial services, where we have a competitive advantage, technology, where we have a competitive advantage. There are areas in where we've fundamentally, and I speak for us and the Australians, of where we believe we compete quite well. In those areas where we do not believe we are getting the ability to open those barriers, we are very clear about our dismay and articulate that on a continual basis. Gary Locke, who's our new ambassador, is the first Chinese American to be the U.S. ambassador to Beijing. He got on the ground about a week ago. John Huntsman, as you may know, who's running for president, was also the U.S. ambassador to China. And I think the combination of the two of them who have been there have made it very clear our intention to open those markets and open up the barriers that allow us to have free and fair trade.
Question down there.
Where our economy is doing very well, we look towards the older parts of the world, the old world, with a certain degree of apprehension. But it seems that there's never been a time when there's such a difference between the new and the old, and the fact that we are so developed that the cost of our labour, the cost of our lifestyle, the ensuing debt, all of that seems to be out of proportion with the other part, the Chinese, the Indians, who are trying hard to build up to our level of whatever we call ourselves, affluent, whatever. To what extent is this tension going to be a problem, this notion of, you know, nice and even balance and free trade and whatever? Because invariably, we're going to have a problem at the domestic level of the pressures of this feeling among ordinary citizens that it's just all getting too tough.
Well, it's a very good question, and you know, this is one of the struggles we always have in trade negotiations, and one of the reasons we're trying to do the TPP, which is really the ability to really create a trading bloc within Asia where you try to even out the economies. You know, it's interesting. I've had an opportunity to talk to a bunch of different groups today, and one of the comments was about similar to this question, and I pointed out to you that everyone should have Australia's problems, right? And you have we take out the floods for a minute. You have a GDP growth probably about 3.5% this year. If you discount what happened with the floods, you have unemployment that's less than 5%. You have an education system, a funding education system, which is the envy of the world. I was talking to a bunch of students today, and the idea how you've set this up in a way that the students have the ability to go to school with or without some financial constraints, depending upon what happens after they graduate. Listen, so far so good. And so the question, obviously, long term, as you all continue to mature and as your economy continues to strengthen, what is the price of that? Right, and I think currently the prices has been pretty good. The balance of trade has been pretty good. With, quite frankly, I was joking to some of the opposition leaders who I spoke to about this issue around the carbon tax, and obviously the opposition has been quite vocal about their opposition to it. And I said to some economists who I was with this morning, I asked them the impact on the carbon tax, and they basically suggested to me that it would have no economic impact. That it was that they weren't political about it, because I asked them what impact would it have on your growth, because you've had pretty healthy growth, and would this somehow stint, would this hurt the growth of the economy in Australia? And single-handedly, based on all of them, I mean, there were some. You know, they were all different spectrums, and they said they felt they wouldn't have any, but would continue to strengthen Australia's position in the world. That they would be, in their view, again, this is their view, this wasn't a partisan view, that would be the, you would be at the forefront of climate change, at the forefront of environmental stewardship. That's expensive, and you might ask yourself, is it worth the price? Again, I say so far so good. We in the United States, wish I could say that we could pass climate change legislation in the United States. We can't get that through. The idea that you not only have that, but you are moving towards something such as a carbon tax, which, again, for whatever reason, the popularity or not, depending on what you see, is certainly at the cutting edge of what this country is doing. So I am, I'm pretty bullish on it, but there is a price to be paid for democracies. You know, it's a lot more expensive to be a democracy than the opposite. It's also expensive to have free and open trade, and also having free and open immigration. All things which can be very messy when you are trying to improve an economy. But I credit you all with being very focused on what you're trying to do, and as I say, so far, so good.
Especially down here, then we go down the back.
Just
speak up a bit, yeah.
Well, the U.S. has some financial indigestion.
It's a nice way to describe it.
Where is your aid program going? Are you relying more on your Aussie?
question about USAID program.
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's very interesting you mentioned that. You know, we, you know, I'm kind of, again, it's interesting, when you travel around the world, you have an opportunity to spend time with obviously the political parties. And I had an opportunity to talk a little bit today about the whole your percentage of your gross your GDP. I guess no, maybe it's your GNI, which is how much you're going to be spending on assistance. And I think the idea of this current government is by 2016 to get to 0.5%. Of that number. Right now, in the United States, it's 0.1%, so we're nowhere near what you all are doing currently. Obviously, our numbers are much larger, just by the nature of our economy's bigger. But, you know, you are, again, at the forefront of what the assistance needs to be. We, in the United States, have a fundamental problem. Beyond the fact we have, as you would say, a little financial indigestion, I would say we're getting nauseous, but... the reality is that with the economy, you know, again, this is all, it's all to go through cycles, but the economy being in a difficult position and unemployment being relatively high, more than relatively high, quite high, people have a hard time understanding why we're investing overseas. You know, it's understandable. You know, when you're looking for a job and you're unemployed or your wife's unemployed, your husband's unemployed, you don't really care about what's going on in Sudan. Or what's going on in the Middle East, or what's going on in Asia. Now, it's our role to educate people to make sure they understand that the reason we invest with USAID and from the Department of State is because it's in our national security interest. It's not just about because we want to make us feel good. The reason we go into and help those in a famine in the Sudan, although it's important to do, we also believe it helps stabilize the country. And if a stabilized country is in the long term benefit to the United States, because if it isn't, we're going to end up having to put the military and military support to help. And that is obviously not in the best interest of the United States or, quite frankly, the world. So we continually grapple with this question of how much is too much. You know, it's funny, I told people today, I talked to a bunch of students, so we have a big debate in the United States, how much do we spend on foreign assistance? And I mean, broadly speaking, State Department, USAID, all of our diplomats, all of our embassies. And, you know, we've asked the American people how much, what do you think the percentage of this of our budget? And most Americans will say, I don't know, 15%, 20%, 25%. We spend less than 1% of our budget on everything we do overseas on our foreign assistance, State Department. And it's in my view, quite low. And I'm fighting, you know, every day to sustain that level of assistance. So I think the quality of our assistance is critical. Not only is it critical because it's doing the right things in many places around the world, but other countries tee off of what we do. So as we cut back in places, other countries follow us. Not everyone, but we are, like it or not, the United States has certainly been out the forefront over many, many years on assistance. And, you know, the good news is Australia is at the forefront in Asia-Pacific on assistance as well. And other people follow you. And so we continually have this battle, but it's struggles for us, certainly in the short term, about how much is enough. But at the end of the day, the programs that we're focused on, not only here in Asia-Pacific, but across the world are, I think, dollars well spent, and we will continue to make the case to the American people.
Go down the back, right down the back, and then up the front, and then down there. Somewhere down the back. Back right? No, back down there.
The U.S. economy is already mammoth, and the debt load is probably what you call spectacular. Unemployment is very high already. What real levels of growth do you expect will be adequate to give people jobs for the future? Particularly sort of kids and things like that. What's your growth targets in terms of a sustainable long term?
Well, I think most economists will say that the growth has to be around 3% to begin to get some actual real job growth. Obviously, we were on that trajectory this year, and then we, of course, had a little bump in the road on a kind of a slowing down of the economy. Part of that was U.S. consumers, but part of that was Europe. You know, the financial sector is you know, it's like people used to say, are all the markets interconnected? We've just learned they're very interconnected. United States gets a cold, European gets a flu. There's a lot of, you know, the contagion does spread around. And I think part of what you've seen, the slowing down of the economy, certainly in the U.S., is a derivative of what was going on in Europe with the sovereign crisis that you were seeing in Europe. Our view of this is that over the, you know, I think the next 12 to 18 months, you know, between 2 to 3.5% GDP growth, you probably won't see it now in the third quarter. You probably, hopefully, will see, you know, 2 to 2.5 to 3% in the fourth quarter. And again, I think as you look to 12, again, it's all about the consumers. It's about the consumer confidence level. And I, you know, we can have a long conversation about what motivates consumers. But we've had a multiple of problems that have hit the United States at the same time, principally the housing market. Housing market is a big derivative of people's self-worth and, quite frankly, their net worth. And as that has dried up, people have focused principally on, do they feel good about the future? And not only do you have high, you know, relatively high, very high unemployment, but you also have a housing sector which has been quite depressed. And we need to motivate, we need to move the housing sector as we begin to clear up the housing crisis that was created over the last couple of years, and people begin to have what we call positive equity in their house. Right now, many people are underwater, but as the housing stock becomes less, the housing prices go up, the value people feel that they have, consumers feel that they can spend again. And I think that will be a total driver of the economy. So I'm, you know, listen, I am, you know, maybe I'm relatively an optimistic person. One thing the United States has is has very strong consumers. The reason everyone wants to be in our market is obviously we have great consumers' ability to spend and obviously to be able to push kind of purchases of consumer goods. So I'm relatively confident that over the next year you'll see growth. What level? You know, it's anyone's guess, but we do have to have GDP growth at least at 3% to actually really do a dent into the high level of unemployment. And you have a lot, which you don't have here, is underemployment in the United States. So even though the unemployment's at 9%, you have underemployment, which is a big part of the concerns that people are taking jobs that are, quote, below what they believe they should be at. But, you know, indicators are that the economy was coming out of this recession. Interestingly enough, I talked to the business community today, one of the chamber groups. You know, U.S. companies are as healthy as they've ever been. They're actually healthier than they've been in the last 5 to 8 years. They have a lot of cash on their balance sheets. They're not spending the cash because they don't have the confidence that the things are getting better, so they're hoarding the cash. You know, and I think once we convince them to start spending that cash, to hiring more people and doing more R&D, obviously that will drive the economy in the way we believe needs to be driven.
A State Department question. President Obama, when he came to office, wanted to differentiate himself from President Bush in relation to America's approach to Islamic countries. And he did this in a university in Egypt where he gave a speech there. We wanted to make more open engagement with the Islamic countries. How do you think that policy is working out?
Well, I just think about what's happened in the Middle East since that speech, right? Look at what someone who lit himself on fire in Tunisia started a, you know, revolution in the Middle East, right? So between you know, Tunisia and what's going on in Syria and what's going on in Egypt and what's going on in Libya, you can go from all through the Middle East. There's something going on there that none of us have actually any idea what the impact will be long term, because it's easy to topple governments. It's harder to build democracies. I'm not suggesting at all that President Obama's role was the igniter of that, but certainly we've been engaged. Secretary Clinton has spent an enormous amount of time. You know, the Libya issue in particular, where we had the Libya contract group, where we made a decision that the United States was not going to lead, but we're going to lead through NATO. Which was a very smart, I think, long-term decision about what we were doing. Obviously, the pressure we're putting on Assad in Syria is pressure that we believe is working and will work over time. The role that we played in Egypt was, I think, the right place, but quite frankly, the story has not been written yet. And I think that as we look at the Middle East, and as you look at how this played out, and you look at the president's Cairo speech, and where he laid out a foundation of what democracies would look like, I can't tell you where it's going to be. I think we feel comfortable that we're moving in the right direction, but as I like to say, democracy is somewhat messy. The youth revolution that kind of, you know, swept through the Middle East has yet to play out. How that all plays out and where we are 18 months from now, what the government formation looks like in Egypt, what we look like in Tunisia, what happens in Syria, what happens in Libya. You know, I can go on and on and on from every country to where it is. I don't know. But there's clearly one thing. We are engaging in the world, we the United States, and quite frankly through our allies, including the Australians, that we need to be part as a team, we can't do this alone. The United States can't do this alone. We can't neither afford it nor we want to. And the lesson we learned in Libya was sometimes it's better to be part of a team than to lead on your own. Now, we can use the power of our voice within the UN and with NATO to cajole our the world's community, which we have done on many occasions, but I think we've learned lessons there, but I think the president has been very focused and, quite frankly, has demanded that we begin laying out a foundation for what the Middle East will look like and how we can help support that in the right and in a way that makes some sense for the long-term stability of the region.
Australia and China's relation is, to me, is kind of a business-like. And Australia and America's relationship is kind of a partnership. They are wholehearted partnership for the past century, for a long time. But what is the essence of China and the U.S. relationship? And to me, China, Communist China, is very monstrous. Communist China spent more than half its foreign reserve to purchase U.S. bonds. And it is in our minds, in our eyes, it is kind of a protection free. The Chinese government paid to the United States. The China just uses its covert rise of China, and future, sooner or later, there will be a showdown between the United States and China if China could not be defused at this moment. So my question is, does the United States have this kind of feeling that it will come or find some way to defuse that?
Question is, will there be a shootout between the US and China? Will this be diffused? I don't think he means a Western-style shootout. I think he means...
No, our relationship with China is like any a strong bilateral relationship, right? We have lots of agreements and we have disagreements. The purchase of the Chinese of the US debt is not done, in a nefarious way. They do it because it's a good investment. Chinese aren't stupid, right? They understand it's a good investment. The Chinese, you know, dollar is strong. It's the currency, quite frankly, and most people believe in the world, and which is a good place to put their money. So there's not many options when you look around the world if you're going to invest in currencies, although obviously the Australian dollars are quite strong. But I think at the end of the day, if you're going to put your reserve somewhere, still I think the United States is a good bet, okay, in my view. I might be a bit biased, but that's my view. And I think the relationship with China is ever evolving. It continues to evolve around trade issues, around security issues, around freedom issues, around access issues. And the Chinese, as their economy grows, will have the same growing pains as many economies do that are growing. You know, a rising middle class, you know, people demanding more freedoms, people wanting more services. That's what happens when economies improve. And you have a big, very big country. We'll work with the Chinese to achieve what they need to achieve, work as a partnership. But I'm very bullish on the U.S.-China relationship. But like any good relationship, we'll continue to have our debates. But make no mistake, the relationship with Australia, the United States, is a bond that will never be broken. This is not just an economic relationship with the Australians, to your point. It's a friendship. It's an ally. It is the country that has worked with us year in, year out, as probably one of our closest allies in the world. And I think that is what sustains us. That's what will continue to allow us to grow. That's what will help us work together as we face other challenges in the years to come.
Put that back. Yes. Yeah.
Chair, I just had a question. You're talking about intellectual property rights in China. Just a question, how do you go about policing that? And given that Google moved out 6 months ago from China, are the Chinese on board given that fine?
It's a work in progress. We don't give up. We continue to fight. We continue to work with the Chinese. We continue to repeat the needs for internet freedom, in particular internet access, the need for obviously issues around intellectual property rights. We're constantly debating these issues with the Chinese. And I think that's healthy. That's what healthy trading partners do. Obviously, the Google case in particular, we were heavily involved in those discussions. We'll continue to cajole, push, convince. These are what we would like to refer to as work in progress. Yes, sir.
Before we get to that, when Christopher Hill was here some years ago, I think he said that the North Koreans were pretty busy printing U.S. currency. Is that still going on?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to my knowledge.
I want to ask you a philosophical question. You talked about institutions in developing countries and democracy. Now, we follow basically, so far as institutions are concerned, a British tradition where the judges seek to be independent from politics and are chosen from people who often have no interest at all in politics. Similarly, public servants don't change the administration, though sometimes a smart one tries to catch the eye of the political minister to advance themselves. But the tradition is that they make their way through experts. And all institutions, of course, in all developing countries and old countries, should do one thing. Do what is right, and
okay,
call the shots as they see.
So what's the...
And my question is, what would you advise the developing countries to do so far as institutions are concerned? Have political people who are interested in following an agenda?
The question is, should the State Department tell developing countries to follow the Americans or to follow us? I mean, I think that's the...
But it's interesting. I think that the systems are very similar. I mean, we have a civil service and a foreign service officers who are non-political, who are sustained year in, year out. The political people come and go. I come and go. I'll be the deputy secretary, and then I'll leave, and someone else will come. And if there's a change in administration 8 years from now or 4 years from now, when Barack Obama, after he wins his re-election, and the next president, next Democratic president gets re-elected 4 years ago, the Foreign Service officers who are here with me today will still be in their jobs. And they are the bedrock of the cohesion of our democratic principles. Because, quite frankly, it's a check and balance. Listen, I think I'm a pretty reasonable guy, right? But they're there to check on me, to make sure that I don't get carried away. So some people call it a bureaucracy. I call it check and balance, right? So I am not allowed to do anything hysterical. That's just the way the Constitution was set up. That's the way the government was set up to allow that to happen. So, in fact, both of our systems are quite similar in that. It's not always perfect because it can create gridlock. Gridlock's also always not particularly great when you have a crisis, as we've learned in the United States over the debt crisis. Now, that was not necessarily a difference between the political people and the career civil service. That was just between the political people and the political people, all yelling at each other constantly. We have the same problems here. I open up the paper today, and the Australian newspaper has all sorts of things about the Prime Minister and if she's going to survive, and should she be replaced? And the opposition is screaming that she should step down, and they obviously want to take topple down the government so they can run. I mean, so you all have the same healthy. That's what democracy is all about. A little messy, not perfect, but it works pretty effectively.
Okay, so we're getting to the end. There's a question here. Have I missed anyone? Yeah.
APEC, you mentioned, is going to meet in San Francisco at the end of the year. Amongst Americans generally, is there much awareness of the role that APEC plays? And does your administration see APEC evolving to any higher degree as an institution than it is at the moment, given, I think, our former Prime Minister Rudd postulated the development of an Asia-Pacific economic community, if I'm correct, or something along those lines, a little like perhaps the European Union has evolved into.
That's a good question. I'd be lying to you if I told you people will walk around talking about APEC at home. Okay, if they are, they need some. You know, anyways, I got to be. I'm on the record. So, but I don't think there's a big debate around at the kitchen tables in Detroit about the upcoming APEC meeting. That said, when you ask them about the importance of Asia, oh, absolutely. The importance of the Asia about our economy, the importance about the market, the importance about export market. You know, when you talk about what's going on, they get that. The institution itself is for the governments to work out. I mean, you know, at some point, you know, it'll become, you know, people will talk about it, but it really is a great institution because it really does, you know, galvanize some of the issues that we need to deal with as it relates to a regional framework. And quite frankly, for the United States in particular, having a key role in that is important for our markets and standards, and that's what we need to strive for. So I think it's enormously a vibrant, healthy, you know, again, like any other large organization, complicated with lots of agendas, but it's clear to me that the strength of it will only get stronger as, quite frankly, the dependency of you know, the Pacific Asia region becomes clearer and clearer to the average American, but of course, obviously, the institutions themselves.
Final question: have you got any hot gossip for us? As you know, for good reasons, President Obama is extremely busy, and we're a long way away, had to postpone 2 visits to Australia. There's some muttering, suggestion, rumours, gossip that maybe November might be in the time frame. Any news from the State Department on that?
I can tell you one thing. The President has a great interest to come here. As you know, I think he was very disappointed he had to cancel both trips, both unexpected, clearly, crises that occurred that needed to come. I know the commitment to come here is great. My hope is that he'll be able to fulfill that quite shortly. But again, I think I leave the scheduling announcements to the White House.
Well, Deputy Secretary, it was worth a try because the state's got some involvement.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, I thought we'd finish well before 7, but we didn't. We've had over half an hour questions and discussion. So I just want to say, it's always great to have senior American officials in Australia. We do have there's a very important relationship with our country, as Mr. Nines has said. I note on this occasion, of course, it's the this year is the 60th anniversary of the formation of the ANZUS Alliance, which has been very important to Australia, but also to the United States. And it's great to see the Deputy Secretary here today, giving us a talk about the US and the region, and taking questions on a wide range of issues, and answering all of them. So well done, and we're delighted you could make it. Thanks to the U.S. Consul General in Sydney and to Reggie Singh at the Consulate for making this possible. And the talk will be up on our pod site, on our podcast tomorrow. Paper will be published in the Sydney Papers online in due course. But for now, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.